The spirit of performance defines Acura. And now, it's electric. Introducing the all-electric ZDX, Acura's most powerful SUV yet. While what powers their cars may change, the energy that makes Acura never will. Crafted using the same formula that brought them electrified supercars and multiple IMSA championships, the ZDX has track-tested performance that packs an energy all its own. With a premium Bang & Olufsen sound system and up to 313-mile range on a single charge, and a Type S variant with an estimated 500 horsepower, the ZDX is everything they said electric could never be. It was built with the driver in mind, just like Acura has been doing since the beginning. We could talk all day, but the only way to experience this electric performance is to drive it yourself. Unlock the energy and order yours at Acura.com.
Live from the Nasdaq market site in the heart of New York City's Times Square, this is Fast Money. Here's what's on tap tonight. The chip dip, NVIDIA topping the tape at the open, but then tumbling nearly 10% from its highs of the day. Is this just profit taking on a Friday or the start of a true move lower? We'll ask the Chartmaster. Plus, industrial surge, shares of GE hitting nearly seven-year highs today. The once mighty Dow component now up more than 30% this year. Is this breakout for real? We'll debate that. And later, a new milestone for Bitcoin, another revved up day for Rivian, and the Oscar goes to... We are live on the red carpet with the stock winners and losers ahead of Hollywood's big weekend. I'm Melissa Lee, coming to you live from Studio B at the Nasdaq on the desk tonight. Tim Seymour, Steve Grasso, Guy Adami, and Rebecca Patterson, former chief strategist at Bridgewater. We start off with the market's latest gold rush, the precious metal soaring to a new record high today, topping the $2,200 mark for the first time ever. It just notched its best week since October and is up 20% over the past year. The latest rally coming alongside Bitcoin, which topped $70,000 during today's session. Rival crypto, Ethereum, also hitting a record. But stock markets taking a breather, ending a topsy-turvy week on a down note. The Nasdaq shedding over 1%, while the Dow shed 69 points, posting its worst week since October. So what does this apparent flight to the safety of gold tell you about the strength of this market rally? Rebecca, happy International Women's Day.
You too.
What do you make
too.
Of this gold move?
I think what we're seeing with Bitcoin, gold, and stocks today, they're completely separate. There isn't one big macro factor driving this. In the case of gold, I'd highlight two main things, China and China. China's central bank put out data yesterday showing that they bought gold for a monthly for 16 months in a row. They're continuing to diversify reserves. That's not going to end, given where U.S.-China trade tensions are likely going. And then China consumer, you saw what happened in the two sessions policy meetings this week. They're not going to stimulate growth enough. The consumer can't make money in property, in stocks, in wealth management products, bank deposits. They're going into gold, and I think that's likely to continue, too. The rate story for gold is a risk because it could go either way in the short term. Right. But overall, I think there's some important structural supports there.
Yeah. In 2022, central
Hold
banks...
Hold on. Can I stop you for a second?
Of course you can.
You've had a lot of jobs out there. He's worked at Domino's. He's been at UPS. Where else have you worked?
Shake Shack.
Shake Shack.
Uber. Lyft.
In addition to all those fantastic jobs. Yeah. This man was a gold trader. So I want to listen to this man's view on gold.
But
so
for real.
Today.
And he didn't have to wear a hairnet. Did you wear a hairnet at Goldman Sachs back in the day?
Only on the strange days. Central banks in 2022 bought 1,141 tons, $70 billion worth of gold. It was a record. Last year, they basically did about the same. It was, again, a record. This year, I'm sure they're on pace. Rebecca's right to bring up China. Central banks, and we've said this, they're hedging their own ineptitude, and I absolutely believe that. And gold's one of those things, and this is going to sound somewhat glib. It's not meant to be. It's not a story until it is. And it's becoming a story because we're leading tonight with it. And this could be one of these weekends where we walk in the same way we walked in a couple months ago and gold has this ridiculous move on a Sunday night. That's what it's setting up for, because everybody might be bullish of gold, but the market is not long of gold yet. And when people start getting in, the institutions, and they try to put the amount of money they're putting into equities into the gold market is not that big. And I think people will take notice. Gold tells a much different story than other risk assets. And I think it's trying to tell the market something right now.
Is this move higher in advance of the Fed pivot of rates going lower?
I think gold has been sniffing out that the Fed has peaked somewhere. So we had a payroll number today, which on the headline looked good. We'll maybe get into that. We may not. But end of the day, this was a number that showed that the Fed certainly has a little bit more momentum on their side in terms of the labor market. I think gold, and I've said this, I'm amazed. People say gold's this crazy. What's this move gold doing? I'm saying What took you so long? You know, to me, gold was actually trading phenomenally well at different times over the last couple of years. But at other times when we thought, and I realize Karen says this all the time, there's an entire checklist of reasons you could say you want to own gold. And they seem to almost be for whatever flavor you want. But the reality is, gold as a 20-year chart, I've said this a lot, I think it's the best chart you can find right now. And the point is that over the last 20 years, the central banks have been slowly doing this. They haven't been rushing in. What's going on now is it's a combination of Federal Reserve dynamics. It's a combination of central bank buying. It's a combination of some sense that I think investors are piling in. I think digital gold people are buying regular gold. And I think there's a lot of reasons why that's happening. And I'll just throw in this.
So all the holders out there, whatever you want to call them, they're buying gold?
Part of the reason Bitcoin exists and its reason for being is that there's fear of fiat currencies and central bank dynamics. Without having to take a political view, because no one wants and cares about my politics. You know, if you watched the State of the Union last night and you watched the rebuttal, I don't care which side you're on. We've got two different countries, and that's why gold is going higher. Gold traded today at a 91 RSI. That's usually like no big deal, but, you know, for tech stocks. But when gold trades at an RSI, and Guy, I think you're saying this, like, this is actually a time you want to buy gold when it looks like it's frothy, because I think actually it's you're seeing real allocation.
So I do believe it was Powell, and Guy talks a lot about this. What is the national debt right now?
$34 trillion.
It keeps going. It moves pretty quick. $33 trillion and then some. It's probably closer to $34 right now. Mm-hmm. Debt to GDP is 123% right now. And I do think it was more Powell than anything else. I think China had a case in it. But I think you're going to see Bitcoin and gold continue to skyrocket because of those reasons.
I mean, if you're doubting sovereign credit right now, U.S. sovereign, I mean, you're a buyer of gold. Mm-hmm. It seems like everything is in place for that thesis as well.
Yeah, and to your point, you know, political uncertainty, geopolitical uncertainty, we're all focused on the U.S. election this year, reasonably so. But there's also elections in the
Taiwan
Middle East.
And,
there's elections in a lot of big countries. If you look at political certainty indices, they're not looking good. Right. There's a lot of question marks around major governments around the world. And that, again, we can think about U.S. buyers in these emerging markets right now who are worried about their currencies being devalued. They're going to gold.
Now, people will say, well, then Guy, Tim, Steve, Rebecca, miners should be trading
well.
Yes.
No, I'm trading it. We're totally on the same page.
Are they calling out everybody's name while they're doing that?
I'm not sure, but since we're all here. Well, you know what happened last night? I mean, we had a situation
where he called everybody panelists.
So I wanted to be crystal clear tonight that I knew people's names. But with that said, you know, I understand. I think the equity community is saying, you know, we've been burned before with miners. We're not going to bother until gold actually proves itself. Well, it's starting to now. And I believe this, and I've thought it for a while incorrectly. When the catch-up trade happens in miners, it's going to catch everybody off guard. And you saw sort of glimpses of it on the surface, although GDX closed unchanged. Some of these miners are on a hair trigger. So if you believe in gold here, you should actually foray into some of these mining
stocks. And it used to be 3-1. It used to be a 3-1 beta on the gold miners would outperform both up and down 3-1. The problem to this is the reason why they're not performing is that labor costs. Feasibility studies have once skyrocketed. Lubricants that are used in some of these digging for these gold mines.
There was lubricants.
That's the first time that word's been used.
Have we ever used that word on the show before?
Diesel fuels. So you have a bunch of stuff at input costs.
I'm blushing.
So I don't think those costs are coming in anytime soon.
So you're not a believer in GDX, but you do like gold.
I do like gold. I like the idea of gold. And one last data point is pre-COVID, you had a Fed balance sheet of $4 trillion. It ran up to 9. Now it's back down to 7.7. And QT is ending. That still gives a tailwind to gold.
Are you worried about miners, or do you think miners should catch up?
I would have been scared to use the word lubricants, but Steve did a good job with that. I would say that Steve's right to point out that the inflationary aspects of what have been going on in the mining industry have actually put a lid on the operational leverage you would think miners actually have in this time. So pointing out that historically, gold miners were 3-1 to the price of gold up or down. They've underperformed outright. Forget a beta of 3, the price of gold by about 27% in the last year. So gold has outperformed. And I think that is a dynamic with inflation. But I agree with Guy. I think the gold miners will catch up. And I think they're catching up now. I've been adding to GDX all week.
I'll give you a caveat. If stocks go down, if political uncertainty rises, if there's worries over growth,
miners are tough.
And miners are going to underperform gold in a major way.
Yep. Yeah.
I would just keep that macro point in there.
But to that point, Rebecca, I mean, you had mentioned that the moves in these various Bitcoin, gold stocks separate for today. But in a way, what gold is telling you has to tell you that there are risks to this rally. No?
To the gold rally?
No, to the equity rally.
Oh, to the stock rally? I mean, I think the stock rally, you have to go back and say, we've got a Fed that now is priced for maybe 3 cuts this year instead of 6, which was the case in January. So higher for longer, bad for stocks. However, we've had an incredibly resilient consumer 68% of GDP. So that's been the dominant factor helping everything. And then you have idiosyncratic stories like AI helping tech, et cetera. Mm-hmm. So to me, even though the payrolls today suggested the Fed can take its time before it starts cutting, you still are seeing, you know, payroll growth moderating but strong overall. You're seeing the JOLTS survey this week moderating but strong. You're seeing the Beige Book, more labor supply, but the economy resilient. So that story hasn't changed. And I saw J.P. Morgan was on just before us. Mm-hmm. They just revised up their GDP forecast again.
Certain people in our world are legendary. Like Paul Tudor Jones, for example. Stan Druckenmiller, I think on February 19th, there was the announcement that he dumped some tech stocks. He actually bought mining stocks. And that, again, you don't have to agree with him, but you absolutely have to sort of, you have to pay attention when somebody like does something like that. He hadn't been in it a while, and now he's in the miners. So
he probably doesn't know what lubricants cost in his defense.
Well, he's older now, so...
I don't know what lubricants cost either.
I'm moving on.
I
mean,
no, you should. You're looking at me. I didn't even do it.
No, gentlemen, it is International Women's Day.
This doesn't seem appropriate at all.
Yeah.
Anyway, TD Securities today telling clients to take profits in gold. Dan Galli is behind the call. He's a firm's senior commodity strategist. Dan, great to have you with us. Why give up on this move higher?
Yeah, listen, thanks for having me on. Listen, over the last few weeks, a few things that you've been discussing have been absolutely correct, right? First part is that investors have been historically underpositioned in gold into a Fed cutting cycle. But when you fast forward to today, a few of those things have changed, right? Firstly, macro traders, and those I'm calling that the traders who care about things like macroeconomic expectations, the number of Fed cuts priced for 2024, their positioning is now a lot more consistent with rates market pricing. The rest of the community, mainly algo trend followers and Chinese buyers, have also bought an extreme amount of gold over the last week alone. So from here, I think the easy part is over. The risk reward to higher gold prices is now dependent on macro trends deteriorating.
So thank you for the comments. If next week we've got CPI and PPI, obviously they're going to be important as we think about what the Fed's going to do, timing, size and speed of rate cuts. Obviously important for gold as we think about the opportunity cost of owning gold. If you got lower than expected CPI, would that affect your view, or is your view beyond that one print?
No, absolutely. Look, we're forecasting gold price of $2,250 for the quarter. So I wouldn't say necessarily that we have a bear call. I would rather say that the easy part is probably over here. If we do get lower inflation and continued evidence of disinflation, then that would support more Fed cuts for 2024. And in turn, macro traders, that's really the last community that you need to start to buy gold. And that would certainly help that.
Hey, Dan, Tim, thanks for joining us. Talk to us about correlations between the various PGMs. I know you're bullish on platinum and palladium. I think silver has underperformed gold if you look at least historical ratios between the two. So, again, there are trades that are based upon industrial use. There are trades that are based upon macro. And there are just long-term relationships between these. Talk about any part of that.
Sure. So listen, the most exciting part of what you said is silver, really, right? So the PGMs are trading exceptionally weak against gold. That relates actually to a trend of destocking. And you know, it's funny because over the last year, we actually had exceptionally strong fundamental information come in PGMs, and they just traded far lower as a result of speculative selling activity and physical destocking. The piece I think that is most interesting for the next year or two is in silver markets. And I mentioned that because there's a few assumptions that we all have about these precious metals markets that might be challenged. And one of them is that we have enough silver available above ground to satisfy the tremendous demand growth coming from solar cells. I think that's going to come under challenge over the next year.
All right, Dan, got to leave it there. Thanks so much. Dan Galli of TD. Silver or gold?
Wow, Burl Ives.
Silver or gold.
Well, right? The bull case for silver at this point, people say gold's at an all-time high. Silver's 50% of what its all-time high. So by definition, it's got to catch up. And that's been out there for a while. Yes, that can happen. And I hear what Dan's saying. Totally get it. I still think gold, this is the setup that I think every gold bull over the last 10 or 15 years has been waiting for. Central banks running amok. Obviously, bond moves we haven't seen historically over the last 5 years have been ridiculous. And again, the fact that Steve brought up debt to GDP, which I think is on people's radar screen, that leads to gold, my opinion.
All right, let's get to NVIDIA now. Having a rare down day after rising as much as 5% and hitting a new high, it closed down more than 5.5%. That's a 10% move on the day. Let's bring in the chart master, Carter Braxtonworth, for more on this. Carter, great to have you with us. You just put out a note on NVIDIA saying that this was a key day for the stock.
Yeah, just briefly, there's something known as a key reversal day. It can happen after a long downtrend and then a reversal, or in this case, a long uptrend. Four criteria. You need a stock that's an increasingly steep intermediate advance. That's the case in the context of a long-term advance. We have that. Number two, on the day in question, the stock opens yet again very strong, often with a gap. NVIDIA gapped up today. And then number three, it fades intraday, actually goes from being up quite a bit. It was up almost 5% to unchanged and continues to slip and closes down on the day meaningfully, closed down about 5-6%. And then volume is at or near a record. Typically, it marks the end of an intermediate move, and it usually has follow through to the downside. So we shall see. But my hunch is if one is big here, reduce a little bit.
Are there certain support levels you're looking to for NVIDIA to hold next week in order to prove to you that maybe this is just a near-term phenomenon as opposed to a longer-term trend lower?
Right. I mean, obviously follow through. Not following through on Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, not having another down week would say a lot. But actually, interesting, on the screen, there is some talk of NVIDIA being quite similar, or maybe is it, to Cisco. And so I thought we'd do an exercise here. This is the past 10 years, NVIDIA 2014 to present. And what you have is the stock's been a compounded annual growth rate of 72%. Now, just to put that in context, let's look at its Cisco in the 10 years prior to its peak. It was an entirely different animal, right? Cisco is a 95% compounded. It went from 9 cents to $69 versus NVIDIA 450 to where we are 975. So just to put that in context, look at the table that comes up next. And what you have here is what would have happened if you have $10,000 invested in NVIDIA from 2014 to 2024. That turns into 2.3 million. 10,000 in Cisco in the 10-year run to its peak, 7.9. NVIDIA is nothing even close to the excess that was seen in Cisco. And remarkably, yet both right now, Cisco's 5.25% of the S&P, and Cisco peaked at about 5.25% of the S&P.
Carter, thank you. Carter Braxtonworth of Worth Charting. We made that comparison, obviously, because there's so many comparisons to the internet bubble and what AI is. But before we get to that, in terms of NVIDIA, if we do see downside next week, we've asked the question before, can the markets go higher without Apple? But I think it's more pertinent today to ask, can the markets go higher without NVIDIA?
It's interesting, right? I mean, Apple actually caught a bid today. So it all actually right. makes a lot of sense. Mm-hmm. And listen, originally I thought with Apple trading the way it was trading, the S&P I thought would have been around 4,200, 4,300. Clearly that didn't happen. We're at all-time highs. But I think the tech leads the way here. And when you think about the market cap that NVIDIA lost today, there may be 15 or 20 companies that size in the world, yet it loses it like this. That, to me, is not a particularly sign of a healthy market.
And when you look at who's been doing the heavy lifting, it's been NVIDIA and it's been Meta. The other names haven't contributed at all. Tesla's down, Apple's down, Google's down. So they haven't been doing any lifting. If you take them out, can the market move higher? It could move higher. It's going to be a lot more of a slog because you have XLV, which is your healthcare, that's up 8%. And then you have industrials, which are up 8%. They're smaller on a percentage weighting of the overall market. So it's going to be a tough load to lift, but it still can move higher.
I think if you look at the rest of the market, it is rallying. And I would argue that over the last 3 days, you've seen the isolation of, it's not just NVIDIA, it's the semiconductor space. So semis are up 30%. They've outperformed as a group, whether you're looking at the SOX or the SMH ETF, the S&P by 28% from January 4th. To me, it's all about semis. But What are we talking? We're talking about banks over the last 3 weeks. We're talking about retail. We're talking about healthcare, other parts of the market that were in bear markets. I mean, we're talking about where were banks last July, August, last summer, and all the dynamics. You can make an argument. We have the same economy. We have the same job market. We have the same consumer. And maybe they're even a little bit weaker than they were, yet banks have finally started to catch up. I think some of that can continue in a benign Fed environment.
Yeah, I agree with that. And I think, to your point, maybe it's more of a slog because there's smaller weights in the overall index. But if you have things like banks being able to participate a bit more along with other sectors you mentioned, industrials, healthcare, et cetera, I think you can go higher. And to me, what was really interesting this week was how strong Powell was in his comment about not going too crazy with the bank regulations. Yes. Mm-hmm. And the fact that they're identifying the weaker banks, they're telling them you got to have a plan. It doesn't mean that we won't have more problems, but it does definitely shorten the tail risk on the left side for that sector.
All right, we've got some breaking news on Sam Altman and OpenAI. Let's get to Steve Kovac for the details. Hey, Steve.
Hey there, Mel. Yeah, the information is reporting OpenAI is about to rename Sam Altman back to the board. We know all the drama going on here. He was ousted as CEO, kicked off the board, came back within days. In addition to that, where information is reporting several other new board members that are supposed to be made. I'm reading here, Sue Desmond-Hellman, a former CEO from the Bill Gates Foundation, also Nicole Seligman, a former president of Sony, and another name that we're familiar with here, Fiji Simo. She is the CEO of Instacart and a former top Facebook executive. We're still waiting for official word from OpenAI on this. I have calls out like crazy right now, but that is what the information is reporting. I wouldn't be surprised if we hear something official from OpenAI quite soon here.
All right, Steve, keep us posted. Thank you, Steve Kovac. Coming up, some electric trading. First General Electric hitting its highest level since 2017, and analysts are taking notice what Wall Street is saying about that one next. And shares of Rivian continuing its surge this week. The EV maker revealing just how many car buyers are already rushing to place orders for its newest SUV. We're charging into that trade when Fast Money returns.
This is Fast Money with Melissa Lee. Right here on CNBC.
Hello, I'm Laura Castleton, U.S. Head of Portfolio Construction and Strategy at Janus Henderson Investors. Is a brighter future possible? At Janus Henderson, we think it is. For 90 years, we've worked to help clients achieve superior financial outcomes and fulfill our purpose of investing in a brighter future together. We know that this means our thinking and our investments are helping to shape millions of brighter futures for the next 90 years and beyond. To learn more, go to janushenderson.com.
Wouldn't it be great to have all your investment and retirement accounts in one place? Yahoo Finance, our sponsor today, makes it easy. I use it to put my investment account and 401k accounts into one hub and get expert tips that help me confidently manage my money. For more than 25 years, Yahoo Finance has been the brand behind every great investor. Whether you're a seasoned investor or are looking for that extra guidance, Yahoo Finance gives you all the tools and data you need in one place. They're the number one finance destination, producing a holistic look at the financial news cycle, including breaking news, original editorial perspectives, analyst ratings, independent research, customizable charts, and so much more. Securely link your brokerage accounts for a unified view of your wealth, including 401k and other investments. A comprehensive perspective is what sets apart great investors, and it's how Yahoo Finance ensures you have the insight to look at your wealth in its entirety. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit the brand behind every great investor, yahoofinance.com, the number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com. That's yahoofinance.com.
Welcome back to Fast Money. GE quietly in rally mode in 2024. That stock up more than 30% so far this year today, hitting levels not seen since 2017. That after JP Morgan upgraded the stock this morning, calling it a premier name. It had been at accelerating for about a decade. So what's powering GE's rally? And I know you remember the day that GE got downgraded by JP Morgan, Stephen Tusa. This is a career making call for him. Mm-hmm. It was a tremendous call. And here we are back to buy.
Industrials, I mean, the aerospace, there's a lot to like about what General Electric is doing, without question. They seemingly turned the corner. And the stock, you could probably still make an argument that, I don't want to say it's relatively cheap, but at least it seems to be growing in valuation. Of course, the problem is Honeywell, which we've talked about for years, had been eating their lunch. Now, maybe the gap between the two is being closed, and that's why you're seeing this. But I still think if you want to play a little stock market here, I would rather Honeywell at these levels, despite the fact that it's when, you know, whisper of its all-time high.
Look, I know
that General Electric has had a ridiculous
move. I know
move.
It's Friday, guy, but I mean,
can't do that?
You just did it on your own, man. You're not allowed to.
Sorry.
There's never a time to break the rules.
Yeah. You know what, Mel? That's a fair point. I'm sorry. I'm not real.
Well, here's another fair point. Larry Culp was, I think he's done a phenomenal job at GE. It's easy to say that now. I think people were very critical in the early days. Mm-hmm. What's really profound to think about, but yet it's kind of obvious in hindsight now, is he's the first outsider to run GE in 125 years. This is a guy that knew what businesses were you know, dead weight, which businesses actually were low growth. They were a conglomerate. They were the definition of conglomerate, and they were all over the map. They were in real estate. They were in entertainment. We know that, formerly, you know, our parent company. So you have a dynamic here where I actually think into aerospace and aviation and core businesses, I think it goes higher. I held it for a long time and sold it way too early, sold some upside calls. This, by the way, is where selling covered calls can hurt you.
Yeah. You own it? No.
I don't own it any longer. I owned it for years. And with the split, I don't even know what's the split adjusted price on this thing, because it's always confusing to me. But when I look at it, I would rather buy.
Bad trend there.
So you come up with comps when you look at GE. So it's not necessarily a real apples to apples, but when you look at an Emerson, that chart looks to me very constructive. When I look at GE, this looks like nosebleed territory to me. And I don't think anyone really understands the true profitability of a company like this. But if industrials are going to perform, this is the number one component of the XLI.
All right. There's a lot more Fast Money to come. Here's what's coming up next.
The force is strong with this one, as the lower-cost R2 revs up some strong early orders. So, can the new SUV help Rivian expand to the masses? We're plugging into that trade next. Plus, is the market ready for Reddit, the social media platform gearing up to kick off its pre-IPO roadshow? What you need to know ahead of the debut. You're watching Fast Money, live from the NASDAQ market site in Times Square. We're back right after this.
What's on the horizon for financial markets? At PGIM, it's a question that over 1,400 investment professionals relentlessly research in pursuit of your long-term goals. Specialized across asset classes, but united in collaboration, our teams provide global and local expertise. Our investments shape tomorrow, today. Pursue your tomorrow with PGIM, a leading global asset manager.
Welcome back to Fast Money. Shares of Rivian continuing its climb this week. The EV maker reporting strong early orders for its new cheaper R2 SUV, which was unveiled just yesterday. CEO RJ Scaringe saying the vehicle, which will start at $45,000, has more than 68,000 reservations already. Despite its 13% climb this week, Rivian shares still down more than 45% just this year. Where are you on Rivian at this point?
I'm not in it right now. Okay. And when you hear 68,000, that's not a lot.
In 24 hours, that's a lot.
I mean, I don't know. It's a Cybertruck. I think that you should be prepared to compare the two. And I think it's still going to be Tesla when it comes to how people pay for these pre-orders. But if you look at how much it costs, it's $1,000 or so to pre-order a Rivian when it's only $200 or $250 to pre-order a Tesla. So if they lower the price for pre-orders, that number is going to explode and they can brag about it a hell of a lot more. The stock has to prove itself. EVs have been under a lot of pressure.
I just look at the performance of this stock in an environment where everything with a pulse for speculators has been going higher. And yeah, I get it. You know, the move from 10 up to 1270 is really dramatic. But the cash burn here, I think the overall, there's not existential questions about EV overall, but there are certainly where the, you know, the first or the biggest wave of early adopters out of the way. It's really more about hybrids. This company is burning cash. There's a lot of competition out there. It's a cool car. It's just not a stock I think you want to own.
The bull case, though, that's being put forth by analysts today is that they finally got a mainstream entrant that can mm-hmm. actually compete. It's not too expensive, so people can actually buy this thing. And they are burning cash, but they're going to burn less because they put off that factory in Georgia, and they still got $10 billion.
I was going to say, they have $9 billion, yeah. 10, whatever it is. People are calling it, you know, this is Tesla 10 years or 15 or so years ago type right. of thing. I get it. they lose, I think, some ridiculous $120,000 every car they sell, which is an astronomical number. However, I mean, it's very Tesla-like a decade or so ago. So if you believe in a story, if you believe in their backers, and they have very significant ones, you can see the momentum catching up in the stock. But to Tim's point, it has not been a performer in an environment where it should have performed.
And we have to talk about Tesla. I mean, you know, you tell me about the performance of Tesla this week. I mean, it really, this to me is a story that I think multiple wise, forget, you know, Tesla's way out in front, but I think they should have had a chance to bounce with a lot of the tech euphoria they have done.
Coming up, we're not quite done with NVIDIA. The chart master laid out the technical take, but now Mike is the options action on this name. How to trade the monstrous rally in today's big reversal. But first, ready for Reddit. All eyes on the social media site as it gears up for its IPO roadshow. Details on how the company is luring potential investors when Fast Money returns.
Catch us anytime on the go. Follow the Fast Money podcast. We're back right after this.
Welcome back to Fast Money. Stocks finishing the day in the red, the Dow closing near the flat line, but closing out its worst week since October. The S&P down 0.5%, and the Nasdaq leading the losses down more than 1%. Shares of Macy's jumping late in the session on reports the retailer is open to directly negotiating a sale with activist investor Arkhouse Management without launching a strategic review. Arkhouse and Brigade Capital recently raising their Macy's buyout bid to $6.6 billion, and reports say they may go even higher still. Shares of Boeing, meantime, dropping more than 2% after news a tire flew off of a United Airlines plane shortly after takeoff yesterday, prompting an emergency landing. The plane was leaving San Francisco bound for Osaka. Not to mention this morning, it apparently skidded off a runway as well. Novo Nordisk, meantime, also down today, though off of its lows. The company's weight loss drug Wegovy, approved by the FDA to reduce the risk of serious cardiovascular complications in adults with obesity and heart disease. Meantime, social media platform Reddit is kicking off its IPO roadshow on Monday as it makes its case to investors ahead of its highly anticipated offering. The company expected to price the stock between $31 and $34 a share for a valuation of about $6 billion. That's about half of what it was worth just 3 years ago. Reddit stock will start trading on March 21st at the NYSE. So what should we be watching for at the roadshow? Wall Street Journal tech columnist Dan Gallagher joins us now to break down what we should be looking for. Dan, great to have you with us. They need an anchor investor, what you say.
Well, I think Reddit proposes it's an interesting possibility because they grew their revenue in the most recent quarter, swung an operating profit, trimmed their cash burn. But overall, on an annual basis, they're still losing money and burning cash. And they're a way, way smaller social network even than compared to Pinterest and Snap, and extremely smaller compared to like Facebook and Instagram. So I think there's going to be a lot of questions about like what their growth prospects are, their path to profitability. And I think that's going to be the main focus.
And when I look at the stock, when it comes out, should I look at it? Everything you just said, talking about Snap, and Snap was, I guess, four times the valuation of this when they came out. Should I look at this as a proxy of risk on in the markets? Can I make that case, or am I being too bold?
I think there's some risk involved, definitely. I mean, this is still a pretty subscale social platform. However, there is a case to be made that a niche social media audience can still be a profitable one. But they've not shown that profit on an annual basis. And I think, we've seen like with some of the recent IPOs, the last major IPOs were about 6 months ago, Instacart, Klaviyo, Arm, and two of the three of those haven't performed as well because they've also continued to struggle on what they've been showing. I don't see Reddit necessarily as a home run right now for the IPO.
Dan, thanks for joining us. How about some of what seems to me a conflict between the Reddit that can exist in the world as a private company and the Reddit that's going to be under a very different set of rules as a public company, not only in terms of disclosures, but in terms of, my guess is real true governance dynamics that what do I know? I just know that this is a case where between a user base and even how they've invited some of their loyal users and contributors to be part of this IPO, there are some questions here.
There's definitely ones, and they're in a unique position because they're also known for having this, kind of freewheeling and sometimes unruly base of very passionate users, and they want to include those users in the IPO. But we've also seen reports that at least some small set of those users are trying to rebel, maybe short the stock because they oppose certain things the company's doing. And Reddit has to draw a fine line here because they have to keep their users engaged, especially the half of their user base that's considered logged in and the most valuable ones. They need to keep that and grow that and grow the business while not turning off those users. So it's a really fine line they have to walk.
The valuation, I think, in the summer of 21-ish was, I think, a little north of $10 billion. If they come out mid-range, I think it's $6.5 billion. What's sort of the level that this is a very disappointing offering in your mind?
Well, I think I would expect it to be lower than what they saw. I mean, if you recall, in the middle of 2021, the markets were actually, I think, maybe even more frothy than they are now, even though it may not seem that way when we look at stocks like NVIDIA and such. Because the valuation, especially on internet stocks, was actually higher then. We hadn't had that big correction that we saw in 2022. And in that time, Reddit's business has grown substantially. And like I said, they've started to show improvements in their cash burn and such. But I think if they try to go out at a premium to that number that was kind of assigned in a more frothy time, I think that would have been a problem.
All right, Dan, great to have you with us. Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
Dan Gallagher, Wall Street Journal. What should we be reading about the IPO market as it relates to market sentiment overall?
I mean, I'm still waiting for this magical reopening of the IPO market. Right. I mean, they've been down so much for the last 2 years. Mm-hmm. And I remember at the beginning of this year, a lot of investment bankers coming out saying, this is the year we're back. The Fed's cutting. Now that Fed cuts have been scaled back, is it enough just having the top certainly in place plus the resilient consumer to get the IPO machine rolling again? We haven't seen it yet, but I would think this is a better environment for it, barring some uncertainty into the election in November that makes people pause again.
I understand a broader markets rallied, but NASDAQ, the stock, had been under considerable pressure until about late fall of last year. And if you look at the move, that this little stealth rally that NASDAQ is having, I think the stock is probably telling you that the IPO market's going to come back probably pretty significantly at some point. With all that said, even with the move you've seen in NDAQ, I still think there's room to the upside in this name.
All right, coming up, how to play the moves in NVIDIA. We'll lay out a trade that gives you a way to protect your gains if there's a bigger pullback in store. That's next. And lights, camera, Oscars. Hollywood's biggest night takes place this Sunday. We'll give you a preview of the main event. More Fast Money in 2. Welcome back to Fast Money. NVIDIA has soared more than 260% in the past year, but the AI darling pulled back more than 5% today, and it was down nearly 10% from its highs of the session. Is there a way to take advantage of more potential upside while protecting yourself from any greater drops? Mike Coe might have some answers from the options market. Mike.
Yeah, sure. So obviously we got earnings out of them. The stock did very well out of that. But of course, this downside reversal that we saw today is basically one of the worst technical signals as far as I'm concerned. Obviously, we gapped higher off the open and ended up closing lower. That's never an attractive situation. If you're going to use options to try to protect yourself after the great year that we've had, the great run that you've had, one of the things you obviously have to contend with is the fact that options premiums are pretty high, despite the fact that we've already had earnings and we've had some of the vol crush coming out of that. So one way to maintain some upside and still give yourself some near downside protection is with the use of something called a put spread collar. So I was just looking out to May, looking to buy the at the money 875 strike puts. As I pointed out before, these are expensive, nearly $75, and then selling a lower strike 745 put, and then financing that by selling an upside call. I was looking to 945, but you could actually stretch that out much higher and still not really lay out much premium. That gives you some upside. Maybe if you want 10, 15%, you can capture that while giving yourself anywhere from 10 to 15% downside protection.
Mike, did you come up with this trade after the pullback today? I'm just curious, like, how you're thinking about the stock and how you're thinking about trading it given the reversal.
Yeah, so it was specifically because of the reversal that I was looking at it. Now, I should say we own several chip stocks, and we owned NVIDIA up until last Friday. So we held it through earnings. That was obviously a premature exit. But, you know, the technical move that we saw today, and it actually startled me, not just for NVIDIA, but for some of the other names we own. We also own Broadcom. We have Marvell. We have a lot of other stocks. Marvell obviously didn't do very well. That kind of price action, and I'm sure the guys on the desk are going to sit there and tell you the same thing. You never like to see something gap open, hit new all-time highs, and then close sharply lower and close to, actually, the lows of the day. That's just not a good technical setup.
Yeah. Mike, thank you. Mike Coe. We've got some more details in the OpenAI board changes. Let's get back to Steve Kovac for some details. Steve.
Hey there, Melissa. Yeah, OpenAI making it official now, naming several new board members, including Sam Altman, the CEO of OpenAI, is returning to the board. They also issued a summary of the report that looked into his ouster and all the drama around that. But first, let's go over the new board members. The new ones are Dr. Sue Desmond-Hellman, former CEO of Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, also Nicole Seligman, the former EVP and general counsel of Sony, and Fiji Simo, we know her very well. She's the CEO of Instacart, and like I said, Sam Altman. And the other board members are staying there. That's Adam D'Angelo, Larry Summers, and Brett Taylor, the former Salesforce and Facebook or Twitter board member, that is. And then let me go over what happened here in the review. So this was done by the law firm WilmerHale over the last several months around the ouster. And some of their findings include that the prior board did have the authority and discretion based on what they called, quote, to mitigate internal management challenges. That's why they fired him. They had the right to do it, but they also found it had nothing to do with product safety or finances or investor relations or anything like that that's been kind of going around. However, they also found that he should not have been fired. They said let me quote here from the release, quote, his conduct did not mandate removal. And also saying that the prior board did not think that their actions were going to cause the upset and turmoil that did. But really very broad here. We don't have the full ins and outs of the investigation. I will also just one more important thing. They are saying they're going to change the governance of OpenAI here. They're not saying exactly how, but they're going to review those guidelines. That, of course, is a major issue, this interesting nonprofit structure they have. So hopefully more details on that to come, Mel.
All right, thanks, Steve. Coming up just 2 days away from the Oscars, Hollywood's biggest night coming at a crucial time for the entertainment industry. How the studios and media giants behind some of this year's biggest box office hits will fare when Fast Money returns. Welcome back to Fast Money. It is Oscar weekend. Hollywood's biggest night is this Sunday. So what does it mean for the studios and media giants behind this year's box office hits? Let's get to CNBC's Julia Boorstin, who's live on the red carpet. Hey, Julia.
Hey, Melissa. Well, this year's Oscars come amid concerns about artificial intelligence and also about the future of movie going. The box office year to date is down 13% from last year's numbers at this time, despite the fact that Warner Brothers' Dune 2 had a domestic opening that was more than double the franchise's first installment. So the studios hope that this year's returning franchises, including Lord of the Rings and Deadpool, will have a moment like last year's Barbenheimer to help get a bit closer to the pre-pandemic box office levels. And this Sunday, the race is on for studios and streamers to win these awards that attract top talent and also promote nominated films, which are nearly all available online. I just caught up with the head of the Academy about the impact of streaming.
Streaming provides incredible access for everybody around the world to see movies that they may not be able to see. At the same time, theatrical is key for so many disciplines of movie making to be fully enjoyed. So we want to exist in a world where both can coexist beautifully.
In terms of this Sunday's Oscar race, Disney Studios have the most nominations, 20 for films including Poor Things. Netflix has 18, bolstered by Bradley Cooper's Maestro. Universal has 18 nominations, and its Oppenheimer has 13 nominations. It is expected to sweep the show. Then there's Apple with 13 nominations and Warner Brothers with 9 nominations. Now, with the blockbuster performance of Oppenheimer and also Barbie, there are some Barbie songs that are going to be performed here on Sunday. ABC is hoping to continue its ratings rebound after viewership hit a low back in 2021.
All right, Julia, thank you.
What's that?
Julia Boorstin on the red carpet, which is back to red. Apparently it was not red last year.
For any particular reason?
I don't know. They just wanted to change. It's an uproar. Anyway, back to the discussion on all of these stocks. Are we just going to sit here and say Netflix wins?
Well,
as a stock? I feel like that's the consensus on the desk.
what we discussed yesterday for me was that Netflix, while it's running now, I think the valuation is less important. And when it was cheap, it was interesting, and it was certainly interesting on a free cash flow basis. Disney, to me, is the name that's more interesting just because, in fact, they seem to have gotten, we have a quarter under the belt where they actually have seemingly turned the corner. And I think that's something that, to me, on a relative basis is more interesting. But yeah, nobody's close to Netflix. No one can make content cheaper than they do.
When you look at the two of them, Disney and Netflix, on a yearly, on a year-to-date basis, Disney's only trailing Netflix by about 2%. So that's a pretty big feat for Disney. And the last earnings cycle, when they reported, Disney has held that gap up. So that's a testament to the changes that Iger has made. So I think you can play Disney better than Netflix, but I think Netflix is getting a little bit toppy here. I wouldn't short it yet, but I'm getting close.
Up next, final trades. Time for the final trade. Let's go around the horn. Rebecca Patterson.
I like GLD higher, but given Oscars, Annette Bening in NIAID.
Thank you for being with us, Rebecca. That was fun. Tim.
Always great special. Having you, Rebecca. Yes. It's International Women's Day, and I brought a very special woman. Do you want to say something, Sky? Oh,
my final trade, Delta Airlines.
Nicely done, well Sky. Done. Steve Grasso.
So Congress bipartisanly has agreed to try to ban TikTok nationwide. That's positive for Snapchat.
Guy. Tim was a heartthrob in college. It should come as no surprise. His daughter's here, but so is his fan club from Georgetown, class of 1980. Listen, make some noise in the background. NDAQ, Melms.
Sounds like a lot of people. Thanks for watching Fast. Mad Money starts right now.
All opinions expressed by the Fast Money participants are solely their opinions and do not reflect the opinions of CNBC, NBC Universal, their parent company or affiliates, and may have been previously disseminated by them on television, radio, internet, or another medium. You should not treat any opinion expressed on this podcast as a specific inducement to make a particular investment or follow a particular strategy, but only as an expression of an opinion. Such opinions are based upon information the Fast Money participants consider reliable, but neither CNBC nor its affiliates and or subsidiaries warrant its completeness or accuracy, and it should not be relied upon as such. To view the full Fast Money disclaimer, please visit cnbc.com/Fast Money Disclaimer.
This podcast is supported by FedEx. Dear small and medium businesses, no one wants happy customers more than you do. So you need a business partner just like you, like FedEx, who understands your passion for serving your customers because they have the same commitment towards you. That's why FedEx offers you picture proof of delivery, packageless and paperless returns, as well as weekend home delivery to 98% of the U.S. on Saturday and 50% on Sunday. See the FedEx service guide for delivery information. What's more, FedEx Ground is faster to more locations than UPS Ground. Trust FedEx for timely deliveries. See what FedEx can do for your business. Absolutely, positively FedEx.